It's been a long day, I guess, for everyone. I hope I will make it interesting for you. It's a complicated topic, and I'll try to do my best and the justice to this topic. Interstitial lung diseases. Talking here. Can you hear me? Okay. And NCB, I wonder if they can hear me too. Okay, so I'll start off by presenting a case, one of my cases at NCB. Mrs. AF, she's a 79-year-old female with no past medical history, was admitted, I would say, about 2.5 years ago to NCB, and that's when I first met her, with cough of 4 months' duration, decreased exercise tolerance. She was PPD negative. She's a non-smoker, but was exposed to her husband's secondhand smoke. Can you see this clearly? Because I'm not able to. So this was her X-ray PA and lateral. And this is what I'm going to talk about, precisely these type of diseases, which are called diffuse parenchymal lung diseases, or otherwise called interstitial lung diseases. And that was her CT. As you can see, in the bases, there's a lot of honeycombing and a lot of interstitial changes in every portion of her lung. So what is the interstitial space? It is the space that surrounds the alveolar space, and it contains these type of cells. It contains the alveolar type 2 cells, the type 1 cells, the macrophages, the fibroblast, and the endothelial cells. It also contains other components, matrix components, collagen-related molecules, and non-collagenous proteins, fibronectin and laminin. Now, what brings about this, fibrotic process? In the past, the original hypothesis stated that there was a stimulus to injury and then resulted in chronic inflammation, injury, and fibrosis. But now the new hypothesis says that there's not like a steady decline in IPF or interstitial lung diseases. There's repeated stimulus that can happen, and that results in sequential lung injury, aberrant wound healing, and fibrosis. And there are a lot of factors that contributed to it. Some are genetic, some are the cytokine imbalances, T1 and T2 imbalance, which I'm going to talk about, that leads to inflammatory response and fibrosis. So basically what happens is whatever the injury is, which we obviously don't know, causes damage to the epithelial cells, and that stimulates the release of growth factors. The most important growth factor is the transforming growth factor beta 1, and also tumor necrosis factor are released. And this basically what it does is it stimulates myofibroblast formation, collagen deposition, matrix deposition, and leads to fibrosis. Now, what is this T1, T2 paradigm and progression of IPF? Type 1 cytokine response is interferon gamma dependent. It causes mononuclear cell inflammation, antigen pathogen clearance, and actually tissue restoration. Whereas the type 2 type response is the one that actually causes inability to clear the pathogen and leads to fibroproliferation and matrix deposition. So we think that there's an imbalance and there's more type 2 response. And actually the different studies that were done are based on this theory, especially the studies on interferon gamma was based on this type of cytokine response. So this is a huge table, as you can see, telling us what are the different diseases that that look bilateral and diffuse, like the one I just showed you. I'm going to focus more on the idiopathic fibrotic disorders. I'll talk a little bit about the primary unclassified diseases like sarcoid. I'll talk about pulmonary Langerhans cell histiocytosis X. I'll talk about LAM, lymphangioleomyomatosis, and I'll show you some pneumoconiosis if we have time. Okay, and I'll talk a little bit also on collagen vascular diseases. So when you have somebody with diffuse parenchymal lung disease, they could be classified into these four broad headings. One is the idiopathic ones, which I'm going to talk about first. The diffuse parenchymal lung diseases that are associated with collagen vascular disease. That the other types, the independent ones like sarcoid, and other forms, the rarer ones like LAM and histiocytosis X. Now, if you talk about the idiopathic interstitial pneumonias, you have one really bad player, and that one is idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, otherwise called UIP, or usual interstitial pneumonias. And then you have the others, which are a little bit, I'll talk to you so I don't bore you too much about it, but we call it all these names, right? DIP is desquamative interstitial pneumonia, RBILD, respiratory bronchiolitis interstitial lung diseases, AIP, which is otherwise called Hammond-Rich, acute interstitial pneumonia, COP, otherwise called BOOP, cryptogenic organizing pneumonia, NSIP, which is a big topic to talk about, and lymphocytic interstitial pneumonia. So these are the types, and of course you have UIP, otherwise called IPF. Very importantly, when you talk about diffuse parenchymal lung disease, you want to get a very good history from the patient, because you want to make sure, because history is very important. So is it an environmental-related disease? Is it a collagen vascular disease? Was it drug-related? So you can take away the offending agent, and you might improve the lung function. Or it's idiopathic, and you don't really know what triggers it. And then what you end up doing is the workup for that will include a high-resolution CAT scan, because there are some very specific findings in a high-resolution CAT scan which will tell you that this is UIP or IPF, or is it another set of diseases which I told you, DIP, RBILD, all those other diseases. If it is not UIP and you suspect something atypical, then it's recommended that we do either a transbronchial biopsy or a surgical biopsy. But the more we think about it, transbronchial biopsies are not done because we're not getting enough tissue to make the diagnosis. So we highly recommend open lung biopsies in these patients, okay, when we suspect idiopathic interstitial pneumonitis or pneumonias. And the open lung biopsy, the yield is about 92%. It is low morbidity, low mortality. And it's very important because the histological comparison along with the clinical features and radiological features will help tell you what type, and it has a lot of prognostic information and that can guide us in the therapy. Also, when we do the biopsies, we like to biopsy more than one lobe. And the size of the specimens, you can never get anything close to this in a transbronchial biopsy. So we like to do open, we prefer to do open lung biopsies. Initially, we thought transbronchial biopsy would suffice. But now the yield is showing that it's only 37% in immunocompetent hosts. So it's not recommended to do transbronchial biopsies to diagnose IIPs. Let's talk a little bit about IPF, which actually has the worst prognosis. So what is IPF or UIP? It is a chronic fibrosing interstitial pneumonia that's limited to the lung and has the histological appearance of UIP. The etiology, of course, is unknown. The age, the presentation is usually the fifth to the seventh decade of life. Annual incidence is about 7 cases per 100,000. But there are certain things that they think might be implicated. For example, cigarette smoking, drugs, chronic aspiration, environmental factors, infectious agents are potential risk factors for IPF. Once you diagnose, because we never know when in the spectrum we meet these people, but the median survival after diagnosis is 2.5 to 3.5 years. And the main thing is, the main killer in this disease is the exacerbations, and that can lead to a very, you know, increase in mortality tremendously. Now, how do we diagnose UIP or IPF, right? The ATS-ERS criteria for diagnosing that. The major criteria are exclusion of other causes, certain drugs, environment. So history, like I said, was very, very important. Now, when you do a pulmonary function test, it behaves just like somebody with restrictive lung disease where there's a decrease in the vital capacity and the FEV1 to FVC ratio is increased and there's impaired gas exchange. So the DLCO, the diffusing capacity, will be reduced, a classic restrictive pattern. Bibasilar reticular abnormalities. So on the CT scan, I'll show you a CT scan where you don't see much of ground glass. Ground glass means it's very responsive to therapy. We see more of the fibrotic, you know, reticular pattern in UIP. And if you want, if you really think that this is UIP or IPF, one can get away by doing a transbronchial biopsy because, you know, you don't want to subject a patient who already has such a bad prognosis to a more open lung biopsy. but they have to meet the major criteria. And the minor criteria, like I said, the onset is 5th to 7th decade of life. It's insidious, and usually the duration of illness is more than 3 months. And when you listen to the lungs, it's very classic. They have the dry, Velcro-type crackles. This is a UIP pager. It's very subpleural in distribution, as you can see. And there's a lot of heterogeneity in the way it looks. This is a CT, sort of an end-stage CT scan of a patient with IPF. You see a lot of honeycombing and fibrosis, and you can see it's also very subpleural in nature. The histological appearance is, it's like I said, certain areas will be very badly damaged with subpleural fibrosis, collapse and obliteration of the alveolar spaces, and some areas, like you see here, will be completely normal, okay? And that's very typical of UIP. The thing that signifies a bad prognosis is the fibroblast. So the more fibroblast foci you have, the worse the prognosis. The predictors of worse survival, I mean, people who do badly are in people who are of older age, male sex, smoking history, the degree of dyspnea, radiological abnormalities, neutrophilia or eosinophilia on cellular analysis. If you see a lot of honeycombing of fibrotic changes, and if you see, like I said, the fibroblastic foci on lung biopsy. When we monitor these people, the two most important factors that we really follow are the FVC and the DLCO. That is the forced vital capacity and the diffusing capacity. We can do something called the 6-minute walk, where we can also see the improvement in that, and resting blood gases, cardiopulmonary exercise testing, but it's not available in all centers, and high-resolution CT scans. There are a lot of things now people talk about, you know, in terms of prognosis of this dismal disease. One is the 6-minute walk test. People who desaturate did worse than people who did not desaturate, so the number it cut off was 88%. Like I said, FVC decline over time indicates a worse prognosis. Pulmonary artery pressure. Now, pulmonary artery pressure is very hot in every disease, and they're looking at high mean PAPs or mean pulmonary artery pressures in people with UIP. And if the number is over 25, it signifies a worse prognosis than people who have a mean PAP of less than 25. What is the treatment then? You know, IPF is really the end of the spectrum of disease, and since we don't really have a known treatment, we use corticosteroids, and then for a steroid-sparing effect, we use cytotoxic agents like azathioprine and cyclophosphamide. I'm going to show you some quick studies on the other drugs that have been tried and mostly failed. The big one was interferon gamma. This was thought to be very promising because it had antifibrotic qualities and it mediated the type 1 response. But the phase 3 trial did not meet the primary endpoint. They still didn't believe that, and they did another trial called the INSPIRE, and they had to abruptly stop the study because there were a lot of exacerbations and deaths, mortality associated with IPF exacerbation. The only study that really actually panned out, and the drug that we use in combination, so once you're already on prednisone and let's say azathioprine, you can add N-acetylcysteine, 600 milligrams 3 times a day to these people. And what it did show was an improvement in the FVC and not decline in the FVC and DLCO at 12 months. And this is the graph showing you acetylcysteine versus placebo. Of course, both arms had azathioprine and prednisone, and it showed a prevention of decline in FVC and DLCO. They've tried many other drugs. This is Enbrel. It showed did not meet primary endpoints. Bosanthin, which is an non-selective endothelin antagonist. The first study did not meet the primary endpoint. The second study is completed, but the results are in progress. And they've also tried Gleevec in the study, and those results are still pending. anticoagulation. There was a Japanese study that tried to use anticoagulation in these patients and showed that it might be beneficial, but it's not used in practice. So how do we monitor, then, a favorable response to therapy? A decrease in symptoms? And if they really show, if you thought it was UIP and the patient did beautifully at 3 to 6 months, then most likely your diagnosis initially was wrong because, you know, it really doesn't melt away with steroids and azathioprine. But the things that we monitor are the total lung capacity and vital capacity, which increases by greater than 10% to show that some drug is working, greater than 15% increase in DLCO, and an improvement or normalization of O2 sat or the PaO2 improvement. We use a lot of these scores. It's called clinical, radiological, and physiological scoring to predict mortality. And the higher the score, obviously, the quicker the death. And obviously, the end point is transplantation. And class 3, class 4 symptoms. And single lung transplant is favored. Rapidly progressing or severe IPF may die awaiting transplant. 5-year survival is about 50 to 60%. So that was about UIP or IPF. They can. But much later, they probably have more morbidities before that than from the IPF. NSIP, a non-specific interstitial pneumonia. Now, why is this different from IPF? There are two types of NSIP, and like I said, if it responds to steroids, it most likely is either a cellular type of NSIP, which has a very good prognosis, compared to the fibrotic type of NSIP, or non-specific interstitial pneumonia, which behaves very much like UIP. So it's usually a little bit younger age group, so 1 decade younger. Prognosis is variable. It depends on, like I said, the fibrosis. Some patients have complete recovery, and there's no sexual predilection, no association with smoking. Now, if you look at it here, it has more of a ground glass pattern than did the previous one, where we saw a lot of honeycombing and fibrosis. And it usually, the interstitium in these cases on biopsy show an infiltrate which is abundant in plasma cells and lymphocytes. So obviously, this actually has the highest incidence with collagen vascular diseases. So a lot of the times when you see diffuse parenchymal lung diseases associated with collagen vascular, it's NSIP. Only a small percentage, thankfully, have UIP. So collagen vascular diseases, hypersensitivity pneumonitis, drug-induced pneumonitis, infection, and patients with HIV. The other one which we see commonly and we use a lot is called BOOP, bronchiolitis obliterans organizing pneumonia, otherwise called COP. We call it COP now, cryptogenic organizing pneumonia. Equal sex distribution, non-smokers outnumber the smokers. The mean age is 55 years. The difference between this and IPF is the duration. So here they'll say, I got short of breath really very quickly. And so with less than 3 months is usually the duration. And recovery is the rule, as long as you give them corticosteroids, but relapses are frequent. This is a patient, it almost looks like multifocal areas of consolidation, almost looks like a pneumonia. So patients who have pneumonias that don't resolve, we need to biopsy them and see if they have BOOP going on or COP. And if you look at the CT, here it looks like a classic non-resolving pneumonia. They have a lot of ground glass appearance to the CT and signifies that they're going to be responsive to steroid therapy. If you do a biopsy, you basically see loose plugs of connective tissue within the bronchiole and the adjacent alveolar ducts and alveolar spaces. Now, BOOP can be, or COP can be either idiopathic or it can be associated with other conditions like organizing diffuse alveolar damage, organizing infections, aspiration pneumonia, collagen vascular diseases, inflammatory bowel diseases, and also in response to other conditions like Wegener's, neoplasm, cancer can be associated with COP and BOOP as well. So we talked about NSIP, UIP and COP. Now we're going to talk about AIP. This one is easy to remember because this is a very fulminant form, and this is what we call Hammond-Rich syndrome, where the patient comes in with a very fulminant lung injury. They're mostly intubated. They have diffuse alveolar damage on the pathology. The age group is usually 40 years of age. There's usually a prodromal illness, which is very, very short, like less than a week or maybe 2 weeks. And they develop severe hypoxemia and respiratory failure. The mortality is very, very high, greater than 60%. And, you know, we always try corticosteroids on those people, but mostly it's supportive care, getting them through that period of intubation and extubation. If you look at the CT, it's very ground glass, and if you do get a chance to biopsy these people, it basically shows hyaline membrane formation and very, very thickened proliferative connective tissue and inflammatory cells. And it can be associated, again, with a bunch of conditions, idiopathic, of course, uremia, infections, sepsis, collagen vascular diseases, trally, transfusion-related acute lung injury, drugs, toxic inhalation. The next two IIPs we're going to talk quickly about are related to smokers. So that's all I would remember about it. And they're called RBILD and DIP. So respiratory bronchiolitis interstitial lung disease. I don't know if you get asked that on the boards, but typically smoking cessation is the treatment and corticosteroids. It has a specific histological pattern. When you do a biopsy, there are macrophages that have this dusty brown cytoplasm in the bronchial lumen. So basically the treatment is smoking cessation and corticosteroids. Clubbing is usually absent. And the male to female ratio is 2:1. The next is DIP, or descomative interstitial pneumonia. This has a little bit worse prognosis than RBILD. Again, it's smokers in the fourth or fifth decade of life. It's really more, the difference is more by pathology. It's very difficult to tell clinically how different it is. Prognosis is usually good. Patients improve with smoking cessation and corticosteroids. Survival rate is 70% after 10 years. So this is how it looks. Very different. Very difficult to tell just by CT appearance. And histologically, it has interstitial chronic inflammation, and the alveolar spaces are filled with macrophages and chronic inflammatory cells. The next one is what we call LIP. This one, lymphocytic interstitial pneumonia, is more commonly seen in females, typically the fifth decade. Corticosteroids arrest or improve symptoms. More than one-third progress to diffuse fibrosis. And the classic association of LIP is with patients with Sjogren's syndrome. That's one collagen vascular disease that's associated with. It's also associated in patients with HIV. Of course, there are numerous other reasons why you can get LIP. Other collagen vascular diseases, pneumocystis, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, and primary biliary cirrhosis. There are certain other, and drug-induced. So this is the prognostic classification. UIP is the end of the spectrum. The best one is drug reaction, COP, eosinophilic granulomatosis, cellular NSIP are the more the ones that have a better prognosis. Hypersensitivity pneumonitis is smack in the middle, and fibrotic NSIP and AIP and UIP have the worst prognosis. So that's about the idiopathic interstitial pneumonias. We'll progress and see some more interstitial lung diseases. Sarcoid is one of the commonest interstitial lung disease that we see. This is the one disease that all you need is a transbronchial biopsy to diagnose. It is a multi-system disorder. It is seen in young and middle-aged adults. It usually presents as bilateral hilar adenopathy, pulmonary infiltration, ocular and skin lesions. The diagnosis is by clinical radiological findings, but the most important is the histological evidence of non-caseating granulomas. The course and prognosis may correlate with the mode of onset. Usually the age group is young, usually 20 to 29 years old. Scandinavian countries and Japan, there's a second peak incidence in women more than 50 years. In the U.S., it's 5.9 per 100,000 and 6.3 for men and 6.3 per 100,000 in women. There's an occupational risk. There's also familial clustering. Now, who are the people who do poorly? It's the African Americans with sarcoid, because they have this HLA DRQB1, which plays an important role, and this is the one that why they suffer disproportionately from the disease. So they usually present with stage 3 or stage 4 disease, and they do not have a very good prognosis. Caucasians can sometimes have sarcoidosis all their lives and we'll never even know. And there are a lot of other races that just have bilateral hilar retinopathy where you don't even have to provide treatment. So the disease is very, very varied. And so when do we actually treat sarcoid is the question. The classic pathology in sarcoid is this non-caseating granuloma, which is pathognomonic. So what are the grades or stages of sarcoid? Stage 0 is a normal chest X-ray. Stage 1 is bilateral hilar adenopathy. Stage 2 is bilateral hilar adenopathy plus pulmonary infiltration. 3 is pulmonary infiltrates without bilateral hilar adenopathy. And stage 4 is pulmonary fibrosis. Now, how do you evaluate somebody who comes to you that you're suspecting sarcoid? History, again, is very important. You want to rule out occupation and environmental exposure for the symptoms. An X-ray, pulmonary function test, very similar. This condition has a mixed obstructive and restrictive pattern, and of course there's a decreased diffusing capacity. We always check the peripheral counts and the chemistry, because certain conditions, this condition causes hypercalcemia. Urine analysis, EKG, eye exam, and tuberculin skin test. Most of these people are anergic. They're PPD negative. Now, how do we work it up? Provide histological confirmation of the disease, assess the extent and organ involvement, extent of the disease and severity of organ involvement, and assess whether the disease is stable or likely to progress, and determine if therapy will actually benefit this particular patient. So, obviously, if you're going to have central nervous system involvement, cardiac involvement, vision involvement, severe hypercalcemia, or severe hepatic dysfunction, systemic steroids have to be prescribed to these patients. If you see that there's progressive organ dysfunction during the prior 3 months, again, you institute the systemic corticosteroids. Severe systemic symptoms, low-dose systemic steroids, stable disease, we do nothing about. We just observe. When we give patients corticosteroids and somebody with sarcoid, we give them high doses of steroids, 1 milligram per kilogram typically. And so we start off with a very high dose, and then we taper them to maintenance. We do a maintenance dosing. We taper them off. We observe. And if they relapse, we go back again to those 6 phases of treatment. So asymptomatic patients, no treatment. I'm talking about pulmonary sarcoid now. Mild pulmonary dysfunction, again, observation, no treatment. Patient who have E. nodosum and pulmonary bilateral hilar adenopathy have excellent prognosis. We only observe. Mild to moderate pulmonary dysfunction, mild to moderate functional limitation. Treatment versus observation. Most likely we will intend to treat, and severe treatment will be given in terms of high-dose steroids. Once you have proven that a patient is responsive to steroids, so after 2 months, you will repeat these functional studies, the pulmonary function tests, etc., and if you see an improvement in the vital capacity and the diffusing capacity and the FEV1, we will maintain the patient on steroids. To institute steroid-sparing effect, methotrexate, azathioprine, and cyclophosphamide have been used. So that is sarcoidosis. Now, interstitial lung disease related to connective tissue. Yes? mixed obstructive and restrictive. So you'll see a reduced FVC, you'll see a reduced FEV1. FEV1-FVC ratio will depend on which is more predominant, the restrictive or the obstructive, and it reduced DLCO, diffusing capacity. There are three conditions that have mixed obstructive and restrictive in interstitial. One is sarcoidosis. The other is histiocytosis X, or pulmonary Langerhans cell histiocytosis, and LAM, which is lymphangioleiomyomatosis. These are the three conditions that have a mixed obstructive and restrictive pattern. In the histopathological subsets in connective tissue, as I told you earlier, is the classic pathology that we see is non-specific interstitial pneumonitis. And 82% of the patients ended up with diffuse parenchymal lung disease, ended up having this, and a smaller percentage ended up having UIP. And these were patients with systemic sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and polymyositis, dermatomyositis. Of course, when you have somebody who's on immunosuppressive therapy with collagen vascular diseases, certain drugs have been also implicated in interstitial lung diseases. Gold we don't use now, but methotrexate, cyclophosphamide, and sulfasalazine. Those are the drugs that can cause diffuse type. They can cause BOOP-like picture, hypersensitivity, pneumonitis-like picture. So you have to make sure you get a good history from the patient, and you have to withdraw these drugs to see the effect. Now, what do we see classically in a patient with scleroderma? Again, NSIP is the commonest, and actually this is a patient that has a UIP-like pattern in somebody with systemic sclerosis. The lung biopsy, however, the most common pattern, like I said, was NSIP. The distribution is subpleural with macroscleric appearance of fine nodular cirrhotic appearance. Some patients have a pattern of UIP. And autopsy has shown diffuse lung disease in about 79% of the patients and a huge incidence also of pulmonary vascular disease in 29% of the patients. Rheumatoid arthritis. Again, NSIP most common, but this is a patient that has almost looking like pneumonias in multiple segments of the lung. And this patient had BOOP with RA. SLE, the commonest finding actually is shrinking lung syndrome, but sometimes we do get diffuse lung diseases of the NSIP pattern, and diffuse alveolar hemorrhage is also presents as a diffuse pattern in patients with SLE. This is somebody who has a shrinking lung syndrome or vanishing lung syndrome where there's elevation of both the hemidiaphragms and subsegmental atelectasis of the lung. Sjögren syndrome, the classic presentation, interstitial disease that appears there is LIP, or lymphocytic interstitial pneumonitis. Polymyositis, dermatomyositis, patient can have IPF, acute pneumonitis with diffuse alveolar damage, aspiration pneumonia is common, organizing pneumonia are the different. This is again a patient with polymyositis that had BOOP or COP, and after steroids, there's marked improvement in the CT scan. The next diffuse interstitial lung disease we're going to talk about is pulmonary Langerhans cell histiocytosis. So when it's only particular to the lung, as you know, it's a multi-system disease, but when it's localized to the lung, we call it PLCH, and it usually presents in the third or fourth decade of life. Female patients tend to present a little bit later. The clinical presentations are dyspnea, cough, chest pain. And certain times they will present with hemoptysis. It is a disease of childhood, but when it presents in adults, it's most likely related to smoking. And single organ involvement is usually the lung, and it's seen in greater than 85% of cases. But of course, you know, the other two types are called lateral sivi, when it has an aggressive systemic form, but it's rarely seen in adults, and the Hans-Schuller-Christian, which has a triad of exophthalmos, DI, and bone lesions, but that's also rarely seen in adults. What is the histological features of this? condition. It's mostly cellular interstitial infiltrates composed of Langerhans cells, lymphocytes, macrophages, eosinophils. The most important part of this is that the infiltrates enlarge to form nodules, which are centered on the small airways. And these nodules later cavitate, either an airway remnant, or sometimes they may have de novo cavitation due to an enlarging inflammatory infiltrate. Now, this is if you look at the CT scan in these patients, you see a very nodular-looking infiltrate with central cavitation. And disease progression is characterized by increasing number of nodules, cavitary granulomas, and appearance of fibrotic scars. End stage is obviously seen with fibrosis, some of which are surrounded by cystic spaces of variable diameter, forming large numbers of honeycombing and paracicatrical emphysema prominent in the upper lobes. So what is the treatment? For children, the treatment is very much different from the adults. For children, we give them chemotherapy, like the Vinca alkaloids. For adults, it's mostly, it doesn't have a very good treatment profile, but smoking cessation is the most important introduction you can do to halt the progression of the disease. And then transplantation. Lymphangioleomyomatosis, again, it's of unknown etiology. It's seen mainly in women of reproductive age and occasionally in postmenopausal women. The characteristics are the commonest presentation of LAM is spontaneous pneumothorax, slowly progressive dyspnea, hemoptysis, chylothorax, and chylus ascites. The cardinal features are immature appearing smooth muscle cells, otherwise called LAM cells, in the lungs, and axial lymphatics in the thorax and abdomen, and formation of thin walled. So it's a little bit. So I'm going to just show you the difference between. It's very difficult to tell the difference between LAM and eosinophilic granulomatosis or histiocytosis X. And they both have these cystic. The cysts in LAM are larger than the cysts in eosinophilic granuloma. I'm going to go back. So LAM, again, it's a multi-system involvement. It can involve other organs, such as the kidneys, where we see the angiomyolipomas, retroperitoneal lymph nodes, liver involvement, uterine involvement, and pancreas. It's complicated by development, like I said, of angiomyolipomas. These are benign tumors composed of thick-walled blood vessels, smooth muscle cells, and mature adipose tissue. The prevalence of angiomyolipomas in a patient with LAM is about 15 to 57%. Biopsy basically shows, if you look at here, the high power, bundles of smooth muscle cells within the interstitium of the cell of the cyst walls. This is one of my cases at NCB where you see the cysts and the angiomyolipomas. So what is the treatment of LAM? Again, they've tried anti-estrogen, medroxyprogesterone, oophorectomy they say doesn't really work. So you really have to refer them to the registry, and rapamycin is an anti-smooth muscle agent which they have protocols on. So you should always, if you have a LAM patient, they should be referred to the registry. So the new trials. There's another disease called PAP or alveolar proteinosis, pulmonary alveolar proteinosis, a very uncommon disorder. It's characterized by accumulation of proteinaceous material within the alveoli. It's male predominant. It occurs in the third and fourth decade of life. And the way it looks is like this. So very much a diffuse parenchymal disease, and the treatment is actually lavage. So you have to take the patient to the OR and lavage their lungs to get this proteinaceous material out. And as they grow older, the disease just actually goes away. The alveoli are filled by amorphous PAS-positive staining material without an inflammatory response. Alveolar macrophages are seen within the amorphous alveolar filling material. We'll just quickly touch on occupational and environmental lung diseases. Any questions until now? It's a tough topic, right? And boring. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about the three or four main ones, silicosis, asbestosis, berylliosis, and coal workers' pneumoconiosis. Just very quickly, if it's for your boards, I don't know if they how many questions they ask. But this is a patient, an 82-year-old man with silicosis. The only reason why this was interesting is because it showed a very sort of NSIP pattern on the CT, but when the biopsy was done, it showed more like a UIP pattern. And the pathognomonic feature of this are the silicotic nodules in the interstitium. So why does this disease result? It's from inhalation of crystalline silica or silicon dioxide. And there are a whole bunch of occupations that can I guess you guys should know or already know. Underground coal mining, I won't mention it. You can just read it off the list. Sand blasting, construction, those are the different diseases. Chronic silicosis develops very slowly. It usually appears 10 to 30 years after the first exposure. It is not uncommon for silicosis to first become radiologically apparent many years after cessation of the job. Chronic silicosis has a radiological pattern, which I'm going to show you, which has a lot of upper lobe predominance. That's called simple silicosis, and as it progresses, you can get what is called progressive massive fibrosis. So how do you diagnose it? The history of silica exposure is very important, occupational exposure, and chest imaging, which I'm going to show you some examples, and absence of another diagnosis that's responsible for the observed observations. Silicosis is associated. Why it's important to know? It's increased risk of lung cancer, tuberculosis and non-tuberculosis mycobacterial diseases, autoimmune collagen vascular diseases, airflow obstruction, and you know, like COPD patients and chronic bronchitis. The three types are simple silicosis, progressive massive, and silicoproteinosis. The classic is upper lung zone nodules that are less than 10 millimeters in diameter and may be irregular. And when these all coalesce, it's called progressive massive. And it's associated with hilar adenopathy and this classic eggshell calcification of the lymph nodes. So this is a patient with not simple, but progressive massive fibrosis. The next is berylliosis. When you think about berylliosis, think of sarcoid. It looks exactly like sarcoid. It behaves exactly like sarcoid. The only way you can tell the difference is if you take the history of occupational exposure to beryllium. And because if you do the biopsy, it's also going to show non-caseating granulomas. So history is very important. And they do this BAL or blood test for beryllium lymphocyte proliferation test. And like I said, it's very similar to sarcoid, and it has an upper lobe predominance. The next is coal worker. None of these diseases, the last three or four diseases, extremely poor. But berylliosis is very slow progressing. The others are more dramatic. Coal worker pneumoconiosis is basically they evolve to massive fibrosis. Again, it's very similar to the appearance of silicosis. It is located in the upper lobes of the lung. It's otherwise called black lung. Chronic exposure to coal dust, graphite, other forms of carbon. There's an association between coal workers' pneumoconiosis and rheumatoid arthritis, and that syndrome is called Kaplan syndrome. This is how it looks. Can't even distinguish it from silicosis. It has very, very tiny nodules and upper lobe predominance. So these three conditions have more upper lobe predominance. Now, this asbestosis has more a lower lobe predominance. Okay, that's the difference. And there are different types of asbestosis fibers. The chrysotile one, which accounts for more than 90%, is the one that's less toxic than this amphibole one. And the main feature, I'm just going to show you the X-ray, which shows this what is called the shaggy heart sign, or shaggy heart sign, and it affects mostly the mid lung and the lower lungs, and it's very hazy ground glass appearance, and that may blur I'm only talking about the diffuse part of asbestosis. I'm not talking about, you know, the other asbestos lung involvement. And it may blur the diaphragm and the heart border, giving rise to what I said was the shaggy heart sign. Later on, as it progresses, of course, you can get very diffuse lung involvement with honeycombing, fibrosis in the upper lobes. If you see hilar and mediastinal adenopathy, they're usually not seen with asbestosis, and you should always think of another condition. Now, this patient actually was a Jacobi case probably a year ago, where all of us thought it was interstitial lung disease. And when we did an open lung biopsy on him, guess what it turned out to be? Somebody asked me that question another day, could this be alveolar lung cancer? So this turned out to be a bronchoalveolar lung cancer. That's why you really can't assume what the diagnosis is. You really have to do some sort of biopsy to diagnose. So this guy ended up having, and I had a similar case of another patient exactly like this that turned out to be. So not all the diffuse parenchymal lung diseases are not cancer. And that ends my presentation. No problem. Thank you.